home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
That's right. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am Rob Watson. And right now, I am, well, actually, we should have a great show for you tonight. Our scheduled guest is Vladimir Dinets. He is an author. He is a PhD. He is a zoologist. He comes from Russia, and he has done some fascinating work studying animals, studying different behaviors of animals in the wild and studying rare animals. And the part of what we wanted to talk to him about tonight, and I'm talking like this because so far we don't have him on the board, so this may be a very short show. If the animals got him and he didn't make it on here, but because I know nothing about animals except they're kind of cute. Some of them are, and some of them are dangerous. Some of the ones that he actually has written about is the songs and dances of crocodiles. So, you know, that's the crowd he runs in. So who knows? So while we're waiting for him and we will, oh, and I think we have him on the line. Vladimir, welcome to the show. Can you hear me? Good evening. Vladimir, if you can hear me, I cannot hear you. You may want to call in. Your mic may not be working. Oh, there we go. Now we can hear you. How are you? Uh-oh. Can you hear us? It sounds like we may be having some technical difficulties here. So,
hello, can you hear me at all?
I can hear you. Can you hear me? We are having some technical difficulties. When we get Vladimir on here live, we want to talk about some of the fascinating things about animals, and we want to talk about homosexuality in the wild, because that is the age-old issue with Vladimir. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now for like 1 second.
Ah, great. Okay. We're just having fun with the technical difficulties of Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining me. I already gave a little bit of a hint about some of your background and some of your fascinating books that you've written. And I wanted to start out with just kind of the basic one, because part of your forte is studying the behavior of animals in the wild, correct?
Yep.
Yeah. So one of the things that for a lot of LGBT people that gets thrown in their faces a lot is, you can't be gay because it is unnatural. What is the occurrence of homosexuality and bisexuality within the animal kingdom?
Oh, you see, the animal kingdom is much more diverse than the human world. So you can find things compared to which any form of human sexuality is very straight and narrow. You can't even imagine what some animals would do.
Okay, so tell us what, for example.
Well, The last thing I saw like a couple of days ago was slugs mating. And of course, slugs are hermaphrodites, so the process goes symmetrically in both directions. And the way they would do it is they hang themselves down on a thread of slime in midair, and then they start the sexual thing that lasts for about 24 hours. And they secret so-called love arrows, which are little needles made of calcite, and they shoot each other in the flanks. And then after having sex for 24 hours, which is very, very tender affair, you can see them caressing each other and playing. And remember, this happens while they are suspended in midair on a thread of slime. And at the end of this, they bite each other's penises and live the rest of their lives still females.
Well, just 24 hours worth of sex. I mean, there you go. I mean, that's pretty extreme anyway. But
moderate, actually. They are much longer.
Then you have the species that have sex and then one of them eats the other one?
Yeah, that's quite common, actually.
I think we should count ourselves lucky as to the human sexual practices. We seem to be a lot safer in any case.
Well, I don't know. Maybe each and your partner is so much fun, it's worth it. I know.
That's true. That would be an interesting book. What if humans had sex like the animals did, and kind of describing some of the potential. What are some of the more diversities for mammals?
Well, with mammals, there are species that engage in homosexual sex, although it might have certain meanings like hierarchical dominance, which is quite similar to the way homosexual sexual acts are used in prison for established dominance.
Right.
There are all kinds of other things going on. I don't think there are sex changes among mammals, but they're quite common in other vertebrates.
Are there evidence of animals that seem to be biologically developed as one gender but seem to accompany the other gender in terms of behavior and who they potentially see themselves?
There are all kinds of weird things. Like in some lizards and coral fishes, there are different types of males, and some of them are big macho territorial males that protect their land and their females, and the other type would be so-called sneaker males that look like females, behave like females. So those big macho males don't pay any attention, and they just manage to steal some sex from females owned by the big guy.
Right. So I want to peel back, going back to your background. You grew up in Russia, and what made you want to study animals?
I don't know. I just never saw myself doing anything else. It's been like since I was maybe 3 years old.
And what kind of exposure did you have, growing up there to the variety of animals in the world?
Almost nothing. I grew up in the center of Moscow, which is a city of 10 million people. In summer, I would get a chance to get outside and experience some wildlife.
Right. With that kind of limited visibility, what gave you the inspiration? I mean, were you exposed to, books and movies that got you interested?
No, I think it was kind of innate. I actually published a paper a couple of months ago showing that this tendency to be fascinated with wild animals and nature is genetic.
And so what got you out of Russia? How did you get out to go start exploring that?
Oh, it's quite a long story. I had relatives in the States, and I was Jewish, so I was facing some discrimination, and that gave me the right to asylum.
So it kind of worked, the discrimination, and gave you exit and gave you a way to get, in touch with your passion.
I would get out one way or another, but it made things much simpler.
So what, tell us some of the things that are in your latest book. Your latest book is, I had it right in front of me. Wildlife Spectacles.
Mm-hmm.
So what, What inspired this, and what are some of the things that you found around the world?
Well, the book is mostly about North America, and what happened was I got to North America, and of course, as pretty much anybody, I knew about Yellowstone and Yosemite and all those other fabulous places that everybody knows about. But when I started traveling around the United States and Canada, I discovered that there is maybe 100 times more interesting places that nobody ever knows, and fascinating things that you can see that nobody ever talks about. Now, even now with the internet, you only can find out about them if you know what you're looking for. For example, there is a little town in Wisconsin where you can go in spring, and there are giant sturgeon fish spawning just in the downtown. And you can walk along the main street and watch them. And nobody knows about them. You cannot find it much anywhere.
And how did you find out about them? How do you uncover things like this? It's sort of like a mystery that you dig into, but how do you deduce that they're there?
Well, it happens usually by accident or by reading like technical literature, which is not popular literature, but original papers where people mention stuff. Because only a fraction of what biologists do ever make it to popular literature, you know, most of the stuff stays in journals.
Right. So what are some of the key animals that you and behaviors that are like kind of the golden points of wildlife spectacles?
Hello? Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, so well, the main chapters in the book are about migration. That's not just birds, but mammals and fishes and butterflies and dragonflies migrating. And there is a big chapter on mating rituals and breeding rituals, like seabird colonies and dances and songs and all that kind of thing. And then there is a nice chapter about stuff you can see in your backyard without traveling to any exotic locations. Because there is a lot of interesting things that you can see, like on your weekend hike in the forest nearby. And again, there is a lot of stuff that people don't know about in general.
And what do you think will be the biggest surprise to somebody who doesn't know?
Well, I don't know. It depends on what you stumble upon first. There is even some stuff that hasn't been discovered yet.
What is the migration of the great whales that is fascinating?
Well, this is actually quite well-known one because it's been used heavily by tourism industry.
Right, and they're kind of big, so you're kind of going to see them.
Well, yeah, some species are easy to see, others are very difficult to find. In fact, they keep discovering new species that have been unknown, believe it or not.
Right. One of the things that was, I think you had going on early on was songs and dances of crocodiles. What is that?
Oh, that's something I did my PhD dissertation on. And songs are pretty much like bird songs, except they sound very different. They sound more like an army tank going up a hill or something like that. And when I started to study them in the wild, within the first week, I discovered that they can also dance. And this has been unknown previously, believe it or not. Even though it's very easy to see.
Can you describe the dance? How do they dance?
Well, they swim. They gather in large numbers, up to 100, and they swim in circles. And sometimes they come with a partner, and then they live with the same partner. Sometimes they would switch. One reason I call them dances is that they're very similar to a village dance party where you can come with your girlfriend and live with a different one or get into a fight if you feel like it, to just enjoy and have a good time.
Right.
Is there
a musical aspect to it? I mean, do they keep a specific rhythm, or is it more of a ritual type dance?
As far as I could see, it's quite chaotic. If there is a rhythm, I wasn't able to detect it.
Maybe we need some young kids to watch it, and they'll find the rhythm.
Yeah, that's possible. It's quite easy to see, actually, if you know where and when to look.
What was one of the rarest animals that you found that surprised you? That you didn't think could exist and found an animal like it?
Oh, well, there are all kinds of things around here. Like, there are insects that pretend to be something else, and it goes on forever. There are ants mimicking spiders, spiders mimicking ants, grasshoppers mimicking praying mantis mimicking grasshoppers, and it goes on forever. And every time you find something like this, you're always surprised because there's just another one that you couldn't even imagine.
Right, right. What kind of things do you think that human beings could learn from studying the behavior of the variety of animals? Like, we were talking about some of the sexual practices, although if we could learn something, I don't know, you know, 24 hours worth of sex or eating your partner after you're done. I mean, those are probably not the best lessons in the world, but what are some of the behaviors that we could take something from?
Well, it depends on what you want to do with your life. I mean, you could learn from social insects and become a very low abiding member of the society, but it will not necessarily be good for you. One thing I learned in my life is that following your basic instincts is a very pleasurable thing. No, you don't have to always follow them. You cannot always follow them. Of course, if you want to kill somebody for looking at your wife, it's not probably the smartest thing to do.
Right.
But when you allow yourself to do what the instinct tells you, it's usually the best thing in life. And of course, animals follow
them,
and that's probably why they're happier than we are.
So when animals start following their natural instincts, which is, you know, I agree with you, and actually kind of core to the beingness of what a lot of people are finding about their own sexuality now, is that their instincts are, you know, other than what they've been told, or they are other than what, you know, society has built systems around necessarily. What have you observed in terms of how the animal culture, if you will, develops as a result?
Well, nobody tells animals what to do. And there are species like chimps where peer pressure can force them to do something they don't want to do. But for animals that are more remote from people, usually there are certain rules, but they're very simple and anything else goes pretty much. Which is probably why you don't see animals in the wild suffering from clinical depression and that kind of thing.
There you go. There's a strong advantage. That's actually pretty fascinating. So there are no animals that are depressed.
In captivity, you see it all the time, but in the wild, it's extremely unusual.
Wow.
Only if it's seriously sick, but you don't see depression by itself.
Wow, that's fascinating. I think there's a strong analogy right there between being allowed to be yourself and to live as you are instinctual versus being, you know, even as a human in captivity.
It can be added that people living in modern cities full captivity. Many, many years ago, I had a chance to live in an Indian tribe in South America, and they had very little contact with the outside world. As soon as the visitors left, they would all walk around naked. And they were the happiest people I have ever seen, you know. I'm sure they don't have a word for depression, because that's something completely out of their imagination.
That's actually pretty brilliant. There was an article that appeared, I think it was in the last week or so, in the New York Times about a huge threat to primate species, and a lot of them facing extinction and everything else. What do you study that at all? And if so, what are the kind of causes for that?
Yeah, I study conservation quite a lot. Of course, the main cause is overpopulation, especially in places like Asia and Africa, where people literally consume everything that moves. And the second reason is growth of material wealth, which allows people to afford falling off by buying crazy things like rhino horn and ivory and this kind of thing.
Right.
And in many countries in the world, the material level of the population grows much faster than the cultural level. So people still behave like it's 14th century, even though they have means to acquire very expensive stuff, and they wipe out entire species just because it's fancy.
Right. Well, and it's unfortunately, I think we have some elitism, you know, with in even in our culture, with you see pictures of rich people going over and slaughtering rare animals, and like it's, I don't understand it. There's some sort of valor to killing something that's rare. I don't get it.
Well, starting tomorrow, we might see rich people destroying all our national parks and federal lands and all this kind of thing. And endangered species.
Yeah, that was sort of a theme that I put out there about the show tonight too. That, you know, it's we're not sure what it's going to be like. Although we're getting rumblings already beforehand, and I have to say it's pretty scary. I mean, it's almost like couldn't imagine it would go this way, but it certainly has. From your background, having grown up in Russia and with, I mean, this is diverting a little bit off our animal topic, but, you know, what do you see, what is your opinion of the potential Russian influence on the election and Trump and all that?
Well, it's not potential. It's been clear since the Republican convention that Putin has some compromising evidence on Trump, and Trump would do whatever Putin says, and the Republicans, of course, will support Trump no matter what.
Right.
It's kind of
agreed.
Because, you know, I can read Russian media and I kind of know what's going on there, and it's a fascist dictatorship. It's been like that for 17 years. I think the book that everybody has to read now is Lord of the Rings, because it's a very accurate description of what is about to happen.
Wow, yeah.
I've been saying it for quite a while, you know. If you look at my like Facebook posts, I've been saying it for many years now. I couldn't imagine that a Russian spy would become the president, of course.
I think this whole last year has been a series of just astounding, bizarre situations that seem fictitious. I mean, it seemed like that if somebody had written them up and put them in a book, they would have said, oh, well, there's kind of a movie there, but it's sort of unbelievable. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, if you look at the diaries of people who lived just before World War One or World War Two, all they're saying is, I can't believe this is happening. It cannot be true. I would never expect this. And that's how their world begins to fall apart around them.
Right, right. So, yeah, it's, we'll watch it and see how that goes. What kind of efforts are there in conservation? Is that something that, I mean, you don't hear that much about it, at least as you used to? I mean, a few years ago, there was a lot of push about the rainforest and everything else. And now, I mean, we have trouble getting people to pay attention to this global warming. What do you see, you know, in the field in terms of people taking that seriously?
Well, there is this problem of shifting baselines, you know, and people begin to think that current situation is normal and let's stick to it as long as it doesn't get worse. But of course, the current situation is not normal and it's getting much worse. And I have a daughter, she's 2 years old now, and I'm really scared for her future. I thought we would have at least another century of a green planet, but now I doubt it.
Wow. Wow. Because one of the things that you've written about is the rainforest and you know, operating in it. What is the situation with rainforests and not just operating in it, but maintaining them?
Oh, it's terrible. Deforestation is catastrophic in Africa and Asia, and it's getting worse in South America. And even if you preserve the forest in many places, there is no wildlife in it because human hunters just kill everything that moves. Especially in Asia.
Wow.
You walk in the forest and you see white snares every 10 steps or so.
And what do you hope can be done, or do you think we're just in a slide that it's not going to be there?
Well, we have to save some of those forests because we would all suffocate without them, but I don't know how much we'll succeed in saving. I mean, the situation is desperate, but it doesn't mean that we have to stop fighting because we have no choice.
Right.
Why the survivor die? And we cannot survive without rainforests.
is the air that is produced from the rainforests and that contribution, is that related to global warming, or are they two separate atmospheric conditions that are really both dire but not the same cause?
Well, the rainforests are the main source of converting carbon dioxide back into oxygen. So they produce the stuff that we breathe. Now, with carbon dioxide level growing because of all the fossil fuels, rainforests are becoming more and more important. And if we lose them, we can die within a few decades. Nobody is saying that because they don't want to cause panic, but that's how it is. It's right. Already quite obvious that we're going to lose the ocean because of carbon dioxide dissolving in seawater and turning it into acid. And that's going to kill most marine organisms before the end of the century.
Before the end of the century?
Yeah.
Wow.
And of course, marine plankton also produces a lot of oxygen, so we're losing both main sources of it.
So how do you get people's attention about this?
There's no good way. People are usually not much concerned about it. They don't like to think about these things.
Right. So
that's why we have a government that's supposed to rule by brains and not by referendum, but that's the system.
Yeah, no, it's we unfortunately the government that's coming in won't even believe the huge preponderance of scientists who are talking about, you know, global warming. It's like anything that is inconvenient is not going to be believed, or anything that their business models might have to adjust to is not going to be believed. And it's the mindset also of a selfish generation that won't be here to see the disaster that they've caused.
I'm not sure about that. Things are happening much faster than anybody thought.
What do you think would happen, for example, within Donald Trump's lifetime, that he would see that would hopefully give him pause, but by that time be too late?
Well, we can see that would essentially sterilize the southwestern United States because the air temperature will be so high. There will be nothing left there. We're already
there will be much more wet there?
Well, the air will get so hot and humid that no mammal can survive.
Oh, wow.
It is already happening in parts of Iran, for example.
And how long do you think it would take before that happens? I mean, it seems like every year we have more and more intense weather situations going on.
I have no idea, because the models that we use don't account for all positive feedback loops. And these new feedback loops are being discovered all the time, so... Nobody thought 5 years ago that the situation we are in now will happen so fast.
Wow. Well, let's switch gears back to the unusual animals that you have gone out and discovered. What are some of the more mammal-like animals that are hiding around that people aren't seeing or aren't knowing about?
Oh, there are lots of small mammals which people don't know much about, like moles and small shrews. You can live your entire life in the forest and never see a shrew, and there are hundreds of them running around.
And where do they live that they are existing and are off the radar that way?
Well, they're all around you. You can hear them moving in dry leaves if you know what to look for, but it's very difficult. I wrote another book a while ago, just trying to teach people to see those things. It's called Finding Mammals. It's in Peterson Guides series. It's specifically about mammals of North America, but it gives you a lot of general advice on how to see stuff once you're in the forest, for example.
And so what are some of those tips? I actually live in the redwood forest myself. So when I'm walking, and honestly, when I walk through the forest, I see no animals at all. And I know they're there. I mean, I know... The typical ones are there. I know we have raccoons. I know we have skunks. I know I do see squirrels. But I mean, I occasionally I will catch a glimpse of some of those. What, how can I go see some of these other ones that I'm assuming are there too?
Well, you can try going at night with a flashlight. Once you are into the forest, you have to stop for a few minutes and just disconnect everything, that all the thoughts that distract you, and just turn into your ears and eyes and start listening to what's going on around you. And you move very, very slowly, and you pay attention to every little noise and every little movement, and this is how you find things.
And do they sense you? I mean, do these animals that are usually not seen, do they have, like, smell humans, you know, avoid humans, or is it just they just move in other circles that just happen to avoid us?
They just, well, if you look at like a shrew, humans are not a big threat for it, but it tries to avoid foxes and feral cats, so that's why it's so quiet and difficult to see, but it also works on humans. So if you move very quietly, you will start seeing things because they're not trying to avoid you specifically. Of course, with large animals, it's a different story because deer or mountain lions would avoid humans at all costs normally.
Right. Well, what about the mythical large animals like the Getty and the, you know, the Bigfoot? You know, is there a chance that there is a large animal that is being avoided or not being seen the same way some of these small animals are?
I'm not a North American, so I don't think there is one anywhere. The last one to be discovered, well, not I'm not talking about marine stuff because in the ocean there is a lot of stuff we don't know, but the last big terrestrial mammal was discovered in the 1990s in Vietnam and Laos, and there hasn't been nothing ever since.
Right.
They find some species of stuff like monkeys, that kind of thing, but it's usually because nobody noticed they were a different species. It's not like they were completely unknown.
So I want to ask a sort of a Pollyanna, you know, hopeful question. is there any potential that some of the stuff that is actually damaging the ecology, that it could actually give opportunity to some breeds of animals to thrive and survive? Like, you know, are there animals out there that might like to eat plastic, or, you know, is it just that everything we have produced is just absolutely numbingly devastating?
Well, no. Animals, particularly microorganisms, use everything. There is a fungus that eats plastic, but for every thousand species that we drive to extinction, there is maybe one that benefits.
Got it. So it's one happy one and a thousand unhappy.
Yeah.
What,
and
even
that one happy species is not, does not necessarily stay happy for a long time.
Right. Be careful what you pray for. Have you done much work in the ocean and seen the different animals there that, I mean, I would imagine there are some enormous surprise animals that could live out of sight from human beings still.
Yeah, I used to work on a whale watching boat in Monterey, and I did some submersible dives, and I do scuba diving a lot. And of course, the farther down you go into the ocean, the more amazing stuff you see.
And what could you describe some of the things that are really surprising, or are they just, you know, these kind of ornate, different looking animals?
No, actually I cannot, because our language is not designed for describing such things. But if you look at deep water animals on the forts, it will tell you what is there. And of course, even close to surface,
right,
there is a lot of stuff that nobody knows about, like the oar fish that maybe 100 people have ever seen. Nobody knows anything about it.
And
the last...
Are these being studied or cataloged besides your work? I mean, are you the, you know, the main one that's looking at giving people exposure to these other kind of species that are around?
Well, of course, people look for new stuff all the time. There is one place in Montreal that watches stuff, for example.
And what is next for you? Where's your passion taking you next?
I am moving to Japan. Probably in August. to Okinawa. There is a new science research center, and I will be doing biodiversity service in Southeast Asia, probably in some conservation. So if there is a big mammal that hasn't been discovered yet, I'm probably going to find it. Just kidding.
Well, speaking of Japan, and you know, and this happened in Russia, and you know, potential all over the place with nuclear energy exposing itself to different life. You know, in the movies, the nuclear reactor does something, and then this strange new animal emerges and is huge and takes over the world. What are some of the real life effects of the different radiation that's happened?
It's all blown completely out of proportion. You know, I'm pretty sure I know who finances all this stuff. I think nuclear energy should be promoted and developed as long as we can, because it's a much better alternative than pretty much everything else. Even
right.
The so-called bubbles, they have huge carbon input, and wind turbines kill a lot of birds and bats, and solar batteries take a lot of carbon to produce.
Wow, fascinating stuff. What other aspects of the book would you want people to know about?
Well, it has some travel tips, so if you want to see certain things, it gives you instructions on when and where to go for different states. So it's a little bit of a travel guide. And it gives some in-depth explanations for stuff that you probably knew but didn't think much about. For example, why do birds fly along flyways, and how do these flyways form, and why they go one way and not another, and why do birds dance and spring and this kind of thing.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. That's fascinating stuff. And you know, we were talking about the sexuality of animals. What species is the most like humans in our mating rituals as we have them today? Or maybe let me ask it this way. Which species is most like nuclear family type human experience?
Oh, there is this species of marine worm in which males settle down close to females and get sucked up by their tentacles and develop into little parasites inside them. I'm just kidding. Yeah, there is such a worm, but speaking of sexuality, nuclear families with strict monogamy are extremely rare. It's a very rare exception. I can think of just maybe a few species that do this.
Are swans have the reputation of doing that. Is that true, or is that a fallacy?
No, not really. They have serial monogamy, I think. Well, there are species that are very similar to us, like bonobos, the pygmy chimpanzees. They are a lot like us, just they have more fun generally. They have all kinds of sex and all kinds of possible combinations.
So, and what about penguins? The one thing that has come up, and I wrote an article about this play that they did with two male penguins raising an egg and everything else. Is that a typical thing for the penguin species?
Not as far as I know. It happened in captivity, so it's not completely like normal thing for them. But of course, nobody says that we have to be like penguins and not like bonobos, you know.
Right. But it isn't the, correct me if I'm wrong, which I probably am, but aren't the penguins the species that where the female lays the egg, but then the male takes it over and basically nurtures the egg and the young penguin until, you know, from then on?
They take shifts, and in some species the shifts can be very long because they have to go very, very far to get food. So they're still both taking part in raising the offspring, but they take turns. There are birds in which males do most of the work, like phalaropes, for example.
Like which other ones do the males do most of the work?
Phalaropes, it's a small species of shorebird. You can see them in the Arctic in summer and on the open sea in winter.
Right. When after you've studied all these different species and all these different animals, which is fascinating that you know, are able to even catalog them all in your mind, and you look back at human behavior, where does that leave you? Where, I mean, what is your impression of what humans have done to ourselves and to the world versus what, you know, going back to your point before, you know, if we had just let ourselves be instinctual, that we might not have done.
Humans constantly use sex or suppressing sex as a way to assume political power or to oppress certain kinds of population or reach some political means. That's what religions have been doing for so long. And by doing this, people who do this, people who assume political power, they rob everybody else of so much pleasure and fun in their lives. It's just unbelievable.
No, absolutely.
There are some species in which, like, the queen would mate and not allow anybody else to mate in a huge colony. And that's what has been happening to people in some way. Not so extreme, but there is a certain similarity.
No, it's very true.
There's people who commit all kinds of depravity, so to speak, in their penthouses, and we keep telling us that we should have sex in missionary position, just to simplify things.
And do you see things in the animal kingdom going off sexuality? Because, I mean, you had mentioned it before in terms of going instinctual and you know, killing. Is there a predatory instinct within some animals just to kill for no other reason than kind of the sport of killing versus killing because of, you know, the food chain and the, you know, those kind of instincts?
I wouldn't call it sport, but for some predators, finding food is so difficult that they don't have the stopping mechanism. Like if you let a wild wolf into a bunch of sheep, it will probably kill them all just because it never had the need to stop before. Because in the wild, even one prey is so difficult.
But would it kill like that if it wasn't in a herd of sheep? In other words, are they the species that just go out to kill, you know, and, you know, even go out to kill when they're not hungry?
Oh, they wouldn't kill when they're not hungry because it's too much work. Animals don't like to do stuff they don't have to do.
Can't bother killing tonight, dear. I'm tired.
Yeah, too much.
So, if you were going to write a fictional animal, what would you pull in from all the different species you've seen to create kind of like the really cool imaginative animal in your mind?
It would be interesting to imagine an animal that is intelligent and can build a civilization, but is better suited for it than we are, because we were never designed to live in like a population of 10 billion. And we have many things that interfere with our ability to live in society.
Right, right. What people read your books, and you have actually, could you describe your, because you have a series of books that you originally wrote in Russia, and then you have a series that you've written since then in your later career. Can you walk us through what those books are and how they all relate?
Well, the first bunch was just travel diaries and field guides. These kind of books. And the first book I wrote in the States was called Dragon Songs. It's about my research on crocodiles and alligators. But it's kind of narrative. It's a little bit an adventure novel, a bit of popular science book.
Right.
And then I wrote this book about finding mammals for Peterson Field Guides series. And now this one about wireless spectacles.
And what is your hope for the readers who pick up your work and absorb it? What do you, I mean, we've talked about a lot of serious things about the earth and, you know, both from, you know, inspiring a fascination to go find more of these animals, observe their behaviors, but then the consequences of the earth and what's happening to it. What do you wish to inspire?
Well, I just want people to get out of their rooms and get outside and see what's around them instead of sitting in front of the computer. Because if you don't know what is there, you will never want to protect it and save it.
Right.
And also, it's so much fun to be outside and see things for yourself.
Yeah, I'm afraid my sons would go out, see it, videotape it, and put it on their YouTube channel.
Well, that's fine as long as he can see it.
Well, he would. I actually have one of my sons is very, very fascinated with that type of thing and gets out and does that often. Although I'm not sure, like me, he knows where to look because we like I said, we live in the Redwoods, but we see the basic ones and not, we'll have to get out there in the middle of the night and just sit. Although I have to tell you, that's a little scary. It's sort of like going, I guess it goes both ways, is that when you get out there and you're sitting in the middle of the night and it's dark and there are things kind of crawling around you that you don't know, you kind of avoid it for that very reason.
Well, yeah, but the more you know about it, the less you are afraid of it.
Where part of the world are you most anxious to get to next to look at, or is Japan it? Did I lose you? Vladimir, did I lose you? Well, I seem to have lost our guest. He's gone. Okay. So through technical difficulties, it was a fascinating show, and I really appreciate Vladimir's time. And I learned a lot. Hope you did too. You have been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. Next week, we have another fascinating show on this show, and this Saturday, there is actually going to be a women's march that is going on throughout the country, and we will be covering that without in Santa Cruz. Our guest is Dr. Deborah Rohde, and Dr. Rohde has written many books on women empowerment and, those issues in society, and we are going to get her live commentary on the women's marches throughout the country, as well as her fascinating new book. So thank you for listening tonight, and we will see you again next week.